Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, a token female. We start the show with this blurb from a new book entitled Token Female. In the late 2000s, as tensions between state and federal cannabis laws escalated, Sabrina Fendrick, a recent college graduate, ignited a revolution within the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws by founding the Normal Women's Alliance. The NWA was a first-of-its-kind nationwide effort to organize and empower women to speak out for legalization. In an era marked by entrenched stigma and limited platforms for women's voices within cannabis activism, while the cultural reckoning of #MeToo was still years away, the NWA shattered outdated perceptions and mobilized a powerful grassroots movement. But Sabrina's fight to amplify women's voices in this male-dominated space would lead to unexpected and complex battles, ultimately resulting in her losing control of the very organization she built. The book's full title is Token Female: Women, Weed, and the War on Prohibition. And the author, Sabrina Fendrick, joins me via Zoom. Sabrina, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I read your book over the weekend and enjoyed it greatly. There's so much to talk about. Let's start with you. Tell listeners a bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Sabrina Fendrick. I'm, as I was just introduced, the author of Token Female. Started my cannabis career working for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML. And after coming across an article, I was inspired to write a blog that inspired a larger movement to start a women's organization within NORML and creating a platform for women to highlight women's issues. There was a 5 to 10% gap in public support in marijuana legalization between men and women. And so there was a recognition that we needed to create messaging directed at the issues that were more specific to women and females. And so I write about my experience doing that as a young 20-something year old who was fresh out of college and didn't know anything about the ways of the world and was had I call it the School of Hard Knocks. And so I spent the almost 7 years at NORML. And then I went to Berkeley Patients Group. So I went from the oldest drug law reform or marijuana law reform organization in the country to the oldest continuously operating dispensary in the country, where I was there for also almost 7 years and helped transition them into an adult use market and get through the COVID, early years of COVID. So, and I have just been, these last few years I've gone through a lot and been processing everything that's happened. And 15 years later, I feel like the story of my time at NORML was a very important time. And the women who were there did some very important work who deserved to be highlighted. So I decided to write a book about it.
Now, your new book, of course, his title is Token Female: Women, Weed, and the War on Prohibition. Tell me about it.
It's basically a memoir about my life. it sort of starts out with my unusual childhood as a Foreign Service brat growing up all over the world and witnessing global injustices and geopolitical changes and bringing a lot of that experience back to the States and some experiences I went through in terms of criminalization of marijuana in college that sort of radicalized me. And so I write about the journey that I take from, pioneering women's soccer in South Africa as a teenager. So I've been sort of inadvertently challenging these gender stereotypes my whole life without really meaning to, but as I've gotten older, I'm realizing more and more how important it is to recognize that and to celebrate it and to offer a word of support for more women to continue to do that.
So now you started at NORML in 2008. What was it like back then?
Bush was still president. John Walters was still the drug czar. There were raids going on. Nobody was talking about legalization in any sort of real sense. It was peak drug war. Arrest records were at their highest levels ever right around that time. And it's such a, because when I started, it was 6 months, we were getting into the primary. So Barack Obama was, and when he was campaigning in the primary, was the first time he talked about marijuana decriminalization. So that was very exciting for the movement. And sort of one of the first legitimate, statements to come from a high-ranking elected official and someone running for the highest ranking position in the country. And then 6 months later, as I write about in the book, those Michael Phelps bong, well, I'm skipping over the important passage of medical marijuana in Michigan. In 2008, there was Michigan and Massachusetts. One decriminalized and one passed medicinal. I can't remember which ones, but it was a big year and it was a big deal back then. And at this point, now we're like, nobody, I'm sure your audience knows and will be very quick to correct and clarify, no doubt.
I had to look it up. I'm having to look it up on Wikipedia. Michigan, you were
Okay.
right. Michigan was 2008. Yes, that was 2008. Yes, the ballot initiative, and also Massachusetts. Massachusetts ballot measure to decriminalize, and Michigan's ballot initiative to legalize medical, and both of which, yeah, and both of which passed.
Right. They both passed and they both got more votes than Obama did in those states. So they passed with flying colors. And then the Michael Phelps scandal happened right after the inauguration. And that was, so there was some excitement around Obama winning the election and his position on what he had said previously, but then he was sort of starting to walk back his position. And the Michael Phelps situation, I'd never seen so many reporters filter through the office before. Even when Obama had been elected and all throughout the 08 campaign and election time. And I to this day I mark that as when the phones just started ringing off the hook and just didn't stop. And it, more than they had been before, there were always calls about people, getting drug tested and arrested and all of that, but this was press and people wanting to start businesses and people wanting to start chapter more than normal, wanting to start chapters. So it was just a really exciting time. Change was on the horizon and was unfolding very, very quickly.
I remember at the time thinking myself that this was that it was we were seeing there was some kind of a sea change. The it was electric, and after that election, it did feel like people did feel like change was possible. It was an amazing time.
It was, and then Holder came out with his statement, and then the memos, the Ogden memo. They, for the first time, they were saying not to prioritize, and whether or not they followed that entirely, but it was the first time that a presidential administration had restrained or expressed an interest in possibly restraining their resources against state legal medical programs. And then it just started unfolding.
Now, I got to ask the now 2008. You mentioned that you that was you tra you traveled out to California for the Berkeley conference, the normal conference in at Berkeley that year, and it was shortly after that that you first encountered the old boys network at work at Normal. First time, not the last time. Coordinator position.
Oh, that one. I'm like, which one?
Well, exactly. That's the as the yeah. Unfortunately,
Yeah.
not the last time.
No, you're right. And I don't want to give too much away because I want people to read the book to get to get the full story, but I will say yes, this was before anything with the Normal Women's Alliance had happened, and yeah, there was a position that had opened up that I wanted to go for and believed I was more qualified for, and had basically been doing because somebody had to manage the communications that were coming in and all the enthusiasm from people wanting to start chapters and do stuff. Somebody had to answer the phones. So, yeah. And then it got passed over to me for reasons that were expressed to be less than professional. And it was so many of these experiences that I write about in the book felt so surreal because I, at first second I'm like, wait a minute, what decade am I in? Am I watching some old 1950s, 1960s movie right now, like of an old office? It's but no, it just is really real. And I guess, I'm not gonna say progress hasn't been made, and the people, women had it a lot worse before I did. Every woman that I've talked to about my book is like, oh, well, yeah, of course, every woman has experienced pretty much everything that I have. I'm other than my childhood, probably. But in terms of gender dynamics in the workplace, every single woman has experienced it, guaranteed.
We'll continue our conversation with Sabrina Fendrick, author of Token Female, Women, Weed, and the War on Prohibition, in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's turn to the Normal Women's Alliance. Now, how'd the idea for that come about?
Well, I had come across an article in Marie Claire that had been shared around called Stiletto Stoners. And it was about women, these women, of course, it was anonymous because everyone was anonymous. Well, not everybody, but most people were anonymous. They were publicly talking about their cannabis use back then. And these women were professional women in New York City that one was a lawyer and one was an accountant. Completely mainstream. And the story was about how they preferred to kick back at the end of the day with a joint instead of alcohol. They just preferred that. And something about that, when I was sitting there, and I think at that point it was in the office, we didn't have an office manager. So it was just me, Keith, and Alan in the office. And we, and the chapter coordinator, that chapter coordinator at the time was there. So I was the only woman on the normal payroll at the time. And so I was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. I was surprised that it hadn't even occurred to me that I didn't notice the gender disparity around me, and that like most of the people I was talking to were men, and just that there were women, but grossly disproportionate. And I was just surprised at myself for not even recognizing that. And when I shared the article on the Normal's Facebook page, and the responses I started to see also just really surprised me. And I had started the Normal Facebook page, so I was familiar with like how many respond typical average number of responses to an article that was posted. And this one got more responses than any other article that had been posted on the Facebook page, which, to be fair, had only been around for a year and a half, but still, it was really moving. And so I wrote a blog about being moved by the comments on the Facebook page, and that went viral. And so there was just, and I had been at Normal for, I guess, a year and a half, I guess, at that point, or a year, maybe just over a year. So I didn't know what was viral or what wasn't. And if what really, I just noticed that there weren't that many women around me or women I was engaging with on Facebook, especially since I could see the demographics on the Facebook page, which was just 90% men or something. And so Chris Goldstein, for those of you who know, he's a longtime activist out of Philadelphia who has worked with Normal, started Normal's podcast a long time ago, and works with all kinds of drug reform organizations. He called up and was like, "Sabrina, you have to do something with all of this. This is an incredible energy that you've unleashed here." And I was like, "Okay, what am I supposed to do with this? I don't know." And he was like, "Well, let's talk to Keith and Alan and we'll figure it out." 'Cause he was like, "This is incredible. This is some unbelievable like responses that you're getting, and we need to figure out something to do with this." And so I was like, okay, I guess. And he really lobbied hard for it. To be fair, that was all Chris. I was the executive assistant. I had just written a blog. I certainly wasn't trying to infringe on anything, or but then Chris convinced them and it became sort of snowballed. Keith started to get it, and other board members started to get it, and so they decided that I should, since I was the only woman in the office, I should do something with it. And took a few months, but I did.
I had Chris Goldstein on the show, gosh, it was a few months ago, a year ago. My gosh, it was a while back. Oh, it was actually shortly after he got his pardon, to talk about that and some of the other stuff. Very smart guy. Very smart guy.
He knew immediately we had to do something with this. I give him full credit.
Some of these things too, I know what you mean. It's like the it's one of these, wow, well, maybe run with this, 'cause this has potential. When you're young and you've not done this before, it's not surprising that you're not the one who saw, wow, this is something that actually has legs. This could go somewhere. And glad that Chris was there to help with it.
Yeah, I mean, I had no frame of reference. I didn't know Jack from squat. I was fresh out of college, so I was a sponge ready for everyone to tell me what was going on and what to do.
And although I hate to sound ageist, you were young and you had energy. And energy and passion for this issue is exactly what you need. The folks who are disillusioned and have been at it for so long that it's just never going anywhere, I'm just slogging through. It reaches a point sometimes with people where they just, it happens, and it's sad when it does, and,
And that's when it's time to take a break, I think.
Exactly, which is why having young people coming in, that's what makes it a movement. That's what makes it a growing movement. I mean, that's what does that's
But I also think that embracing young people is something that, obviously I'm not young anymore, and I'm not normal anymore. But I people take advantage of the energy and idealism of the youth, and to a point where I think it can drive disillusion and lead to certain disillusionment later on. And when it that sort of work, I just I it aside from the movement and from Normal, just sort of watching general nonprofit basics and general advocacy basics, like remove whatever the issue is. They're all run by young people. Congress is run by aides and staffers that are 25, which is terrifying. But we should honor all our young people too that are out there.
Let's get back to the Normal Women's Alliance, because this is a the Women's Alliance faced resistance even from within Normal. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of questions about what was the point of the Normal Women's Alliance, what was the purpose of it. Some accusations that it was an attempt to separate the movement. But I mean, in 2025, it almost seems un like it's hard to explain from my perspective, but yeah, people did not understand the point of it. I mean, I think, sort of a lot of some of the backlash we're seeing in today's culture with DEI issues. Maybe that's connected. I mean, I'm not a feminist scholar or anything. I think there's a lot of layers here. It's all very complicated, but I was surprised that it took more convincing and more articulating of its purpose than I thought I would have needed to. If that makes sense. Especially since it wasn't an ideological thing. I mean, the NRA had a woman's program within their advocacy group, and the ACLU had a woman's program in their advocacy group. So there was always these other groups, these established, sophisticated nonprofits had created platforms for women. So it only made sense to do that inside of Normal. But different people for different reasons maybe felt threatened by it. Or I don't understand why somebody wouldn't understand the need for it. So it's, but that apparently was a big issue.
I was active with politically progressive groups back in the 80s, and as my political education advanced, I noted any number of times the problems with Normal, the problems with drug policy reform in general was that too pale, too male. It was always that, and it shouldn't be. And I would, occasionally people would nod in agreement, and occasionally you'd get the eye rolls, complain about the behavior of some person who may be heading some other nonprofit and the horrible sexist, misogynist stuff that he's engaging in, and you get the you're just jealous. I understand. It's
The people younger than me, I mean, I can remember both time periods. I just find it hard to imagine how you can even like articulate that these were behaviors that were just accepted as normal. I mean, with normal with an A. It just is. It's a weird. I mean, having especially since I just turned 40, so I'm really, really riding that line and on both sides of both generations. Yeah, a lot's changed.
I think that you're I think that comparing it to the sort of anti-DEI backlash, the diversity, equity, and inclusion, the backlash against diversity, equity, and inclusion. Got to remember to say all those words because anybody can be against an acronym. Anybody can be against a couple of letters, but are you being against diversity, equity, and inclusion? And I mean, why are you against those? That's the
And it's probably so triggering. It is triggering for so many people, and it, which is unfortunate because I think it distracts from the more nuanced narratives that this little acronym encompasses. And it just sort of shuts down anybody's willingness to understand it. I mean, even just breaking it down, I talk a little bit about framing in the book, but diversity, equity, inclusion all on their own are completely separate objectives. And so the goals within those objectives are all different. And the Normal Women's Alliance as a would I guess fall under that, but the story is just it's so much more than an acronym, I would say. And I hope that it doesn't trigger people to the point where they don't want to read the book or understand the journey.
Let's talk about Afro Man. His single, Because I Got High, originally came out in 2000. I hated it. It was utterly negative. I wondered when it came out, I wondered if he'd been sponsored by the drug czar's office. I mean, it was just. Then years later, several years later, about a decade ago, he did a new version. And that's a version I like. It has positive lyrics, fat beats. You had something of a hand in that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I always had a love-hate relationship with that song because it's a great song, it's epic, but it's also just reinforces those negative stereotypes. And I always thought about how cool it would be to do a remake, a positive remake. And I write about this in my book as well, and more detailed. But essentially, his manager reached out to me. He was coming out with a new album and wanted to collaborate. And it was my last year. It was the last big project I did for Normal before I went over to Berkeley Patients Group. And I told her that her name is Lulu Cohen, and we got on the phone, and I shared this idea with her, and she brought it back to Afro Man, and he loved it, and we started collaborating, and I helped. He wrote it, and I helped get the facts right so we could line him up with all the facts that had been presented in 20. What year was that? 2014. Yeah. So it was done in support of a couple of initiatives that were going on that year. And I brought Weed Maps in. And this was when Weed Maps was under the helm of Justin Hartfield, who had been a long supporter of drug reform. And Justin supported it. And they produced a music video behind it. And we launched it right before the election, if I remember correctly. And it got over 1 million views in 24 hours on YouTube. And in 2014, it was huge.
How can people find out more about your work, about your book? You have a website, social media, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm on the social medias. You can find me on Facebook, just my name, first name, last name, Sabrina Fendrick. And you can, my book that just came out is available on an ebook, Kindle ebook edition currently. So you can download it right now and purchase it on, just go to Amazon and type in token female, TOKIN apostrophe space female, FEMALE, and it should pop up. The paperback will be available in the next, I can't remember when this is airing, but the paperback should be available by the 25th at the latest, but hopefully sooner. So you can follow the Token Female Facebook page to find out exactly when that is going to happen.
Sabrina, any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Well, thank you for your time. I hope you take the time to read my story, and may it inspire you to write your own.
Sabrina, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was my conversation with Sabrina Fendrick, drug policy activist and author of Token Female: Women, Weed, and the War on Prohibition. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I thank my guest, Sabrina Fendrick. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it, and you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture, along with an archive of past shows. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!